is handling the security for Nickelback easier? And that's because they're Canadian, by the way. Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback, Kindle, or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. I don't know. What do you want me to?
I think some of that stuff, at least when I talk to guests, it's such low hanging fruit where you're kind of like coming up, I'm recording with Bo from Dukes of Hazzard, and he's got this crazy backstory. And obviously I'm going to talk about Dukes of Hazzard, but I'm not going to talk about people last year who were pissed at the Confederate flag car. I'm not going to talk about.
Is he the blonde brother?
Yeah, he was Bo. Yeah,
he was my neighbor.
Damn.
So I walk into this. I walk into the house, and they're doing this estate sale, and I cruise into the house, and I'm like, man, this guy really likes Dukes of Hazzard. I just didn't put it together that it was his house, and there's like. There was a photo of him that's like 6 foot tall. And I'm kind of thinking like, but at the end of the day, I was the dude's house. So I bought a little painting of some shoes. I remember, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was my neighbor. And then the Dukes of Hazzard car used to be my other's neighbor's house all the time because that dude's friends with blues guitar player. Amazing. He's probably in his 20s.
Teddy Wade Shepherd.
Yep. So that car was always in the driveway. And my buddies, you know, you drive by and you do one of these of like, oh, I want that car so fucking bad. And you go back this way.
So funny story. And I'm friends with Kenny. And I literally just saw him a couple weeks ago on tour. And he was elected into the, I believe, the Blues Hall of Fame or something in Memphis or Nashville, whatever it is. Well, it turned, someone went back how people go to all the celebrities years ago. He supported that friend you're talking about, the Confederate car. And he's very pro. And so Kenny Wade, they asked him about it. He goes, I'm not taking down that tweet. He's my friend. And he goes, that Confederate flag car does not represent racism. To me, that represents a good time and all this stuff. Well, they denounced him from the Hall of Fame.
And
he said, fuck those guys.
And his father.
Yes. It's crazy.
What the fuck? I mean, this guy's done a lot for music. What the fuck? You know?
It's crazy. People are just so stupid.
Yeah, I thought it was sad. I forgot. I brought it up with somebody who toured with them on here. But it was the whole, like, I don't know. It's not cool because when you've spent so many years of your life with progress, it's kind of nasty to have some bullshit pull you back down.
Yeah, and it's just like, dude, that guy's done more for Black relations and African Americans in music than anyone outside that isn't Black. And you're going to tell me that this guy's a racist because he's his friends with the guy that owned the car? It's just like, dude,
well, no, cares? It's his car. It's his car, and then but he doesn't have the exact emblem on it. He changed it a little bit. He put his own spin, I guess is the best way to put it. But fuck, does the car look cool?
Yeah, totally.
It's really cool. He has an old truck too that's badass.
Yes.
So, anyway, totally random. How are we doing, Justin?
I'm good. You guys hear me? Is that my level's okay?
Yeah, we were at the point. It didn't even matter if you logged on, dude. We were partying over here.
It sounds great. Now, it's so funny, dude. You talk about the Stars and Bars thing. I live in New Orleans, man. And down here, Black folks fly Stars and Bars. It's a different thing. It's a different thing. The Deep South has a grasp of what that flag represents, quite honestly. And it's really Northerners and like a lot of these other places that have really no understanding of it and how it affects the area. You see
they
people
had
all the
here,
time.
You know, in Hollywood Forever, the cemetery in Los Angeles, it's pretty famous spot. They put movies up and you can watch horror films in the cemetery, but there's one of the Ramones is buried there. Alfred
Johnny's
Hitchcock's
there.
Is there. Yeah. So it's a cool spot. I think it's fun to do this, to do the film thing. And they had right in the front, as you drive in, there was an area that was saved for Confederate soldiers and they pulled the stone out that says that section, what it's for. So It's just there. But all of them were Confederate soldiers who had left and died in the LA area, I presume. So
I always find that ironic because they'll have a lot of old actors buried in there who are basically notorious pedophiles and everything else back in the day. So it's just like, yeah. It's like, where do you draw the line on what they think is decency?
I don't know. Remember the John Wayne one, man. John Wayne made that super racist statement that they throw out all the time. And you're, you know, you read it and you want to think the best and you read it and you're like, that one's pretty fucking bad.
Well, yeah, they probably want to. Well, look, yeah, they probably just want to do away with him. How many Indians he killed on film?
It was the horses, man. They would put like a lineup and then they would just run the horses and kill them all. So, and then what was it? Was it the NASCAR one with Tom Cruise? Remember where he killed all the birds on the beach? And that's when they
Days of Thunder,
man. Yeah. And that's where they'd get the guys to cruise them. Anyway, let's introduce you guys. I don't know. You're the one who said you had all afternoon.
sure,
maybe that was me. Justin Press is a Silver Spear security lead. He's a former In This Moment security head. He's the social media engagement manager for Shiprocked, and he did A&R for the Music Experience. He's also the co-host of the Making Waves podcast. John Guerin. Guarnieri.
Yeah.
John Guarnieri is a security.
Close enough.
Close enough. Now, what does it say? Was that wrong?
Guarnieri. You're good.
John Guarnieri is the current security director for Shinedown and Smith & Myers. He's the COO of Silver Spear Security. That's like a tongue twister. I didn't notice till I said it aloud, man. Silver Spear Security, and amongst other acts, handles the security for Nickelback. So my first question is for you guys is handling the security for Nickelback easier? And that's because they're Canadian, by the way. That wasn't
I'm the COO. So I actually answer to my CEO, Chris, but Nickelback, they're some of the best guys in the industry. They're awesome. They take care of their families, their crew, everything associated with them is just awesome. I know a lot of the people like to give them flack and will say, oh, this band sucks or they don't, whatever. I mean, they still pack and sell out stadiums and arenas around the world. And so their security is kind of, it's, they don't do a lot of meet and greets. They don't charge people for meet and greets. So all their meet and greets they do are through the radio stations and different promo giveaways, which is kind of cool.
It makes your job easier, right? I assume.
No, and it does. And they're also just really down to earth guys that sure they got their stalkers and their over the top people. But from a security standpoint, they don't create a lot of work, which is great because they actually are they're not even on social media as individuals except Mike, the bass player. But yeah, I mean, there's the standard, there's been bomb threats and stuff like that, but there's nothing crazy out there.
What's Mike's email?
No, he's pretty active on social media. Mike Kroger. He's really good with talking with the fans and stuff. He's kind of like their mouthpiece when people want to get snippy on Twitter. He gets pretty creative with their comeback, so it's pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah, I can't speak to their security, but my former boss Lane used to initially book them when they were coming up on that first album, and they would route them through about 6 or 7 Texas dates. And to this day, he's still the promoter they go to when they're going through Texas for dates, because they're totally loyal to people who were loyal to them and believed in them back in the day. So they are, like John said, they're down to earth, super good guys. And just that kind of like respect they give to people who looked out for them, that speaks volumes about them.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hate in the world, but the truth is you can count your money all the way to the fucking bank too. Nickelback, they might've been the biggest band in the world.
Yeah, I mean, when you sell close to 70 million records, it's pretty tough to beat. I don't care what band you are, what genre. They keep selling tickets, they keep selling merch, they keep just producing, and they everywhere they go, everyone can sing at least 3 or 4 of their songs at the top of their lungs, and they always do. So. Haters gonna hate, I guess.
Yeah, I think the thing with them is that they always get criticized for this kind of formula they have. But you know what? Name a band of success that doesn't. AC/DC has a formula.
I was gonna say AC/DC.
Aerosmith has a formula. They all have a formula. That's why you know within 10 seconds who that band is. And that right there is what success really is at the end of the day. Is like And you know what? If you're still in people rattle around in people's heads, whether they love you or hate you, you know what? You still got their attention, and that's super important. And like Chad is a songwriter. He writes for Celine Dion, everyone else. He's an artist. That's what artists are supposed to do. And as far as the punk thing, I always laugh about the punk thing. You know, when you're a punk guy, you're supposed to end your punk years around 26, 27. You're no longer the angry young guy. But you look now, those guys are all dads. They're all sponsored by whether it's Vans or guitar companies or whatever. But I also find it funny. You have events, which I love, like Punk Rock Bowling, where you have the Circle Jerks who are all in their 60s coming out and singing the same songs they sang when they were angry 20-year-olds. You know why they're doing it? Because they got bills to pay. So does that knock the punk credos on its ass or what?
Oh, yeah. I went to my buddy from Bad Religion's party when he had his first kid, and there were all the Bad Religion guys there with their families. And I'm like, this isn't very punk. And he's just looking at me like, shut up, you know, shut up.
Yeah.
Drink your beer and draw a painting at my fucking kid's thing. That's the point of this or whatever. We would like,
the whole thing about punk rock is an ethos. And to me, punk rock is doing exactly what you want to do. If Nickelback wants to write the same kind of music they do all the time, that's up to them. They're making that choice. And when you make your own choices, you're punk. No one's making them for you.
Speaking of punk, that band Turnstile, it's churning up right now. That's punk's gonna go mainstream here real quickly with them. And it's just really cool seeing a band like that get the pits going, it's just super awesome watching them throw these concerts they did through the pandemic, where it was just like, hey, no vaccine, whatever. We're playing in Central Park, show up if you want to show up. And some of the footage for that stuff, that's true punk rock. That's rock and roll. And I wish more bands started doing that stuff.
So security dudes, how often do you guys get to ride in helicopters?
I myself never.
I've done it 3 or 4 times out in the government. Well, did that aspect of my life. And then
you get to land on like a cruise, like a big old like submarine ship looking thing.
No, nothing like that.
I'm just thinking of you like Mission Impossible guy, you know, be like, listen here, Tom Cruise, this is how you get out of
it. I've been in areas and stuff that a small handful of people have ever been in or on or around. But funny story, when we were doing this Nickelback thing, actually, there's the idea of them helicoptering into Hannah, Alberta, Canada, where they were born and raised from and where they got their start. And the idea was dicks, because obviously helicopters, there's always this thing where it's this, they could crash. It's not the safest way to travel.
Yeah.
So that idea was kind of thrown out there, but ultimately it wasn't used. But my time on them has been pretty fine. I mean, I've never jumped out of there like Splinter Cell or anything from Tom Clancy. But I do prefer airplanes or cars, or just walking is my mode of travel.
I was just walking to Canada.
Yeah, when we did Rock in Rio, and they fly you in on helicopter because there's too many people at the venue. And but the crew, you know, we just go in like 3 days before and just wake up for 3 days by drinking Guaraná or whatever it was. So we all just wanted to get in a helicopter because we were down there for weeks, and like we couldn't bribe them. We couldn't get anything to let those guys let us in that helicopter. So it's still like bucket list. You know, I see the helicopter, I'm like, motherfuckers, I want on. So
yeah. It's good on movies and TV shows. It's not really that cool.
Airwolf was the shit.
Oh God.
Airwolf. All right, well, so yeah, old school.
We never get the ride of the Valkyries scene from
Apocalypse Now.
There we go. We never get that out of our heads either when we think of copters.
Old school TV shows, Mr. T, man. So Mr. T was a bouncer and stuff. Are you guys?
Have you seen that meme where it shows the inside of a helicopter cockpit and it says the switch for Fortune and Son on and Fortune and Son off? It's like every time there's a helicopter scene in a movie, it's always CCR playing. It's the best. It's Americana, baby.
Yeah, it is. All right, so Mr. T was America's toughest bouncer. He actually won an award as a young man as America's toughest bouncer. And then he did security for a ton of people and stuff. So I hung out with a few security guys here and there, and I found like you guys had these big motherfuckers, and those guys didn't really have to do anything other than just stay big. And it was the little dudes that were the scary ones. They were the ones who could handle their shit. Has it changed at all?
Justin, you go first.
Well, John and I actually have this conversation quite often because he and I are sizable guys. We're not like, you know, we're not, I mean, we both work out and take care of ourselves, but security, really top tier security, as far as we're concerned, is about observing stuff, reading the room, and just influencing people with your presence and being direct with people. That gets their attention more often than someone who's just kind of a bruiser. Because again, you're right. We might be, we're a little bigger than normal size people, but you don't know what we're capable of. And the last thing you ever want to do is get into confrontation, because then you're looking at lawsuits and everything else, and it becomes more of an issue than it is. I think usually when you do a meet and greet or that type of situation where you can kind of go out and you meet up with the crowd before they come in to meet the artist, you kind of lay the ground rules. And obviously the last thing they want is being let out of the room because it's embarrassing for them. And it's also a hassle for anyone. And why go through all this and spend money to do a meet and greet if that's the case, to go through that? So basically, I think if you just have a commanding presence and some sort of authority and, you know, you treat people, our thing is about giving respect to the people as well. If you're respectful to them, they'll be respectful back to you.
I remember, I'm a little fella, but on STP, we just didn't have a lot of people around. And I had this guy jump on the stage who was like massive human being, just huge, huge dude. And he jumps up on the stage and he looks at me and I look at him. And the thing is once they're up there, they're thinking, what now? And then so I walked over and I shook his hand, and then I just kind of put my hand behind him and we walked off the stage, and the guys in the band were like crying. They're like, that was the best security guy moment I've ever seen. But you could see in him, he got up there thinking, what do I do? And if he jumped into the audience, I don't know, man, he was a big fella. I don't think they would have caught him. That, and sometimes the barricade's way too far away, you ain't making it. So I wonder, kill them with kindness, you know, how often does it work? But if you're too kind, then you don't have that you don't have that superiority.
It's I agree with everything Justin said. To carry on with that a little bit, the perception is people know why you're there. And if you're really good at your job, they definitely know why you're there based on how you move, how you react, how you just present yourself. Because in this industry, I don't care if you're a security or catering or a truck driver, how you represent yourself is one thing, but you also represent the rest of your crew, the band, the entity that what you're out there with. And so that's super important. And the top security people I know in this industry now, whether they're former government or military, wherever they are, the people at top tier celebrity, band security, their mind is their best asset. Sure, can everyone throw a punch or grapple or throw it? Sure, that helps you. But if they're in a situation, a crowded bar, you're not wrapping someone up with a Brazilian jiu-jitsu hold and then making the guy tap out if you were the client. You're getting in and out. And so a lot of the times, the most successful security guys, they've already planned out every scenario in their head. If there's a fight in the bar, an active shooter, an unattended bag, or a medical emergency, you've already figured out every egress route. You figured out everything part of your job before you even step foot in these areas. And a lot of times the big guys and stuff that look like bouncers, or they're your second cousin and then you're only paying them $200 a day, those are the people that they don't last. And I just kind of sit back and just kind of chuckle. And this day and age, security is one of the first things people like to cut and one of the last things people like to bring on. And so if you pay what you get for it too, and as Justin can tell, some of these events we've done on, whether they're theme cruises or festivals and stuff, it's like if promoters don't want to carry the best around, well, they're not going to get the best results.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, physical fitness is great, all that stuff, some sort of training background, always be learning. I know during the pandemic, Justin and I were taking all the COVID tests, workplace violence online classes, human trafficking online classes, all this stuff. So you always have to be learning. You always have to learn, adapt, stay ahead of the curve. But there is more to security than just looking tough and looking oiled up to your tits and flexing in front of ladies. So
can you guys get me Jesse James?
The biker the
motorcycle
guy?
Fella? Yeah, motorcycle yes. Fella was security.
Yeah, he was married to Sandra Bullock.
Right, that yeah. dude. Yeah, he yeah. was a security guy for Danzig.
Yeah, and he was also
which I always find ironic
his wife too. So
yeah, but I think one other thing to add to is that John mentioned is like when you're part of security these days is basically your pre-show talk with your vendor security. You're dealing with you're figuring out, hey, give me your best guys in the front, give me people at the bombs, you know. So that's another thing too, is that becomes a communication and teamwork thing. It's you and the venue at that point. So basically they're helping alleviate the front of house, things like that. Obviously security bomb checks, everything at the front door, and you're taking every care of everything as far as dress rooms, backstage, and you know, getting your band in and out. So sometimes it is helpful to, if you can have a good, that's why advancing is so important with those security folks, because they know exactly what they're going to walk into. There's nothing worse than an hour before show and you're finally meeting them and you're like, okay, hold on, we got to break this down real quick. But so our pre-checks are super important. Joel, I love the story of how you handle that, and that's the proper way to handle it. I mean,
the guy was so massive, and I'm like,
gone are the days. Unless they get aggressive or one of your folks, whether it's the crew or the band, then you have to basically, you know, you're gonna have to go all gladiator on them. But other than that, leading them off, not causing a scene, leading them down. It's like anyone that comes over the top during crowd surfing. You don't chunk about anymore. You basically let them go to the edge of the barricade and work their way back in. You'll probably see them again in 20 minutes. They'll be back up on top of people.
So I used to walk them down, and then I'd say, you know, hey, if you do it again, though, I got to kick you out. But that was badass.
Sure.
Coach made the show. And they're usually pretty good. But, I mean, you know, I jumped after Scott Weiland, I remember, into the audience, and I'm cruising around. And then before I knew it, I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm screwed, because it turned into a mosh pit. Scott could handle himself for sure. All the guys in the band, they were tough. And so afterwards we had a talk, and the talk was like, dude, I can handle my own. I now had to watch you and me. And I was sort of like, I did see that happen. There was some truth to that, because it's true. He had to make sure I got back on the damn stage too.
Well, John's in a position, so John can tell you, but as someone who's watched John have to follow Brent from Shinedown and Smith Myers into the audience a lot of times. So John has to, and there's always great still images of John. And he's just like I call him the sheepdog. You know, he's just got his eyes are everywhere. He's transfixed on his artist. And it's like John has one eye here and another eye kind of roving like he's a robot. Just making sure that Brent has a clear path to whatever's going on, or if he sees someone coming his way.
So speaking of eyes, is shifty eyes something you guys look for?
I go to some random event.
Okay. What are some of the tells that you guys are just naturally looking at now, just in life and everything, of like, well, that's weird.
Pacing, clenched fists, talking to yourself, no direct eye contact. If it's 70 degrees out and you're wearing a winter jacket or a long coat, what are you hiding? What's wrong with you? Stuff like that. But I mean, ultimately, if you hear something different, or it's just what you see is, you, all three of us can look at something and be like, oh, the sky's blue. That's the normal. Well, if the sky turned red all of a sudden, we both said, like, what do you normally see in your daily life that makes you question something that seems out of place? And so those are all pre-attack indicators, really. But that doesn't mean they're going to be aggressive. That person might have dealt with a family loss at home, or maybe they need medication, or they're diabetic, or they need their shots, or whatever it is. So it doesn't always be the worst case scenario, but there is stuff how to properly analyze really quickly what someone's up to.
The drugs make your job harder. So like, I had a guy on here, this roadie dude, who was pretty, and he was making a big point at the end that we should make it okay for roadies to be able to do drugs on stage. And he was talking about smoking weed and stuff. And I'm like, all right, I mean, I don't know why that's such a big deal, but sure. And then I'm also, what about LSD? And he goes, yeah, absolutely. I'm like, all right, forget it. When my world, I grew up, most of the tours I did, there was no drinking while I was working, for sure. There, you know,
it's the way it should be.
Yeah, it's a damn job, and you need to be, I think, the best you can do, dude, which means you shouldn't be fucked up. Now, microdosing has become so, so, so popular. Have you guys found in your line of work that drugs being more common, and I don't mean weed is whatever, I mean drugs, have changed how hard your work has become, or does it really not matter?
Are you talking about the audience or working with crews that are dabbling?
I meant the audience, but maybe it's
the
cruiser. Yeah, have you had any time where, you know, I talk about it in my book. I was working for NSYNC, and Lou Ferrigno like wouldn't leave the band alone. He was his fan, and they actually got security dudes whose job was, a lot of it was to keep fucking Lou Ferrigno from bugging NSYNC.
You won't like me when I'm angry.
Yeah.
Well, he just was hanging out. He obviously had nothing to do, so he's hanging out and he's talking to them. But
I mean, that's a lot of people. That is a lot of people though, because some people just feel that's their way of dealing with someone they want to admire and meet. That social awkwardness. Where again, it's like something like you did with that guy on the stage. You just, hey man, get ready to go. We're heading to the bus. We're gonna check out, go to the next city. It's all stuff you could say that can easily mitigate and control that situation. Because I don't know if you really want to say the wrong thing to Lou. He's out there snapping people's necks and ripping skin off, and all of a sudden you got a incredible Hulk.
I just thought it was so funny. We're booting the Hulk.
Well, that's a weird dynamic because you have someone who's very iconic in Ferrigno with a band at the time that was the most popular band in the world. So I think celebrity thinks that celebrity should have entree into that world without any kind of thing. Like they should be my fan. I'm much larger globally than they are. So yeah, it's a weird dynamic. As far as the drug thing is, I just got done about a month and a half ago doing this 4-day EDM fest in Lake Paris, California, which is like a camping fest. So there's really no, the police would come by, the California patrol would come by occasionally, but we don't really look for that so much now. Nowadays it's like bombs and that safe nation. If we come across them, we're like, either get disposed of this or we'll dispose of it for you, but we're not going to hassle with the paperwork. That's kind of the mentality for a lot of these promoters and stuff like that. I don't really run into that. I didn't run into it there because what happens with a lot of people, especially for those kind of shows, they're on acid. They're kind of more of the psychedelic things. And if you come in there firm and sober and talk to them, they kind of don't know how to deal. They're like, kind of like to them, it's like seeing the devil. Like, who is this person who's so like level-headed talking to me? And I'm like, you know, they're off in another place. So they listen very quiet. They do listen to you. So I haven't run into issues. It hasn't gotten violent. I think the days of those kind of drugs, the uppers and speed and things like that, those are kind of slowly dissipating and people are kind of going to more mind altering drugs as far as like something that kind of keeps them a little bit more aloof.
So they're like David Lee Roth. And you're like, I'm not David Lee Roth. I'm a security guy, man.
Yeah, I'm not that guy.
I'm not that guy.
No, I walk up to them eye to eyeball them. I try to respect them. Even if I know they're in a different place, still respect them and just talk to them like an adult. And if I have to, the first thing I always do is go, do I need to take you to medical? They don't want to do that because they want to seem like, no one wants to seem like they can't handle the shit, right?
That makes sense.
I can handle my drugs. I'm like, maybe not now you can't because it's 120 degrees out here at midnight. And you're probably on a couple of mollies. So let's get you some oxygen and some water. And then you go about your business. But my biggest problem with things like that is the environment. That one's particular because it's the festival takes place on a lake. And after 6 o'clock, swimming is closed off. So you have to basically be like Roy Scheider in Jaws, making sure that no one's going in the fucking water because they're on drugs or whatever, and their drowning situation can happen. I'm thinking, well, now I have to bring in lifeguard training into my situation here if that happens. So you're trying to monitor, you're trying to keep all the cats in a herd right over here by here, but these stages, and I don't care what you're doing, just stay out of the fucking water and don't go walking in the highway. So you have to balance out, you know, there's all these are bad things in a normal situation. You'd want to control every situation you have.
Music that way, safe.
Yes, that correct.
Water bad.
And but prior to that, I did a blues festival that John had me go on. It was like one of the first things I did kind of overseeing for Silver Spear. And it was also a beer festival. So obviously a lot of drunk. So a lot of times customer service is like number one. We're customer service at first and foremost. So I didn't have too many problems. A lot of people were able to handle their drinking, even though the elevation is pretty bad. But I found one guy who was working, who was his day off, and I recognized him through the week. And he was loaded. And I said, well, how far do you live from here? Because I don't trust you because you have to walk on a highway to get to your cars or whatever. I said, I'm not feeling this kid. So I walked him like 2 miles to his house.
Oh, geez.
From the it was the middle of the afternoon. I'm like, we've got this covered. We have enough staff here to cover everything. I'll be back and an hour or whenever I'm going to be back. So that's one of those things is like, sometimes you do take that personal touch. Like there's something about this kid that needs my direct attention or this could be trouble.
That's cool of you though.
Little
afternoon stroll.
Little stroll. Yeah. Hey man, a stroll through the mountains. I'm all good with that.
Yeah, it's good. All right. So we're going to go back even farther here. I read an interview you did here, Justin, and you started working at Next Stage by telling them that they sucked is what my notes say. So what happened? How did you begin your career? What in music? Is this not you?
Oh, did I suck? Oh, dude, actually.
No, you told
that's not me. That okay.
They sucked, and then they you started.
No, not so. No, let me tell you, I started this business. I If I told them they sucked, I'd never work in this damn business.
Well, that's what I thought I read. And I'm like, you told them they blow and then you went in.
No, dude. So there used to be this place. It's still around. It's now called the Texas CU Theater or whatever sponsors picked up the building's naming rights. It was called Next Stage at the time. It was outside Dallas in Grand Prairie, Texas. And it was kind of the beginning of these new, very lush, mid-seater 6,000 cap rooms, you know, where they kind of spent a little bit more money on basically the experience. Chairs that are like plush, fucking cup holder. I don't remember a cup holder in any arena show I used to go to when I was growing up. So it was like cool. The staff there was very well dressed up, very well mannered. I went to go see a Styx and REO Speedwagon show of my then girlfriend. I went there, I was super impressed with the sound, the show, the staff, parking, everything was really work. So I wrote them a letter, dude. 2002, we still wrote letters. So I sent a letter into them just to say thank you for the time. It was great. I look forward to more shows. And like a week later, I got a call from the girl who ended up being an HR person. So we got this letter. I said, yeah, it was a great experience. She's like, do you want to come in an interview? For I'm like, for what? She's like, a production runner. And at the time, dude, I'd worked in the label end of things. So I'd gone to shows, but I dealt with artists doing certain things in radio stations, but never in the live. So I didn't know the lingo. I'm like, what the fuck's a production runner?
Oh, it's like, a great illustrious job.
Right. Well, so funny. So I go in there and I interview, and I don't know what to wear. So I wear a suit. I go in there just because I'm like, you dress for the kind of, it's not the, you know, if I would have known I'm dressing for the job, I would have worn a Steve Miller t-shirt, right? That's yeah. How I knew what I was dressing for. I went in there and they're like, well, this is what you do. And I went into that interview. I came out of it and said, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing here on out. This is my fucking shit.
Left you had everything a, hold else on, behind. You cut out on me. You had a what?
At a CD store.
Oh.
And also, I was also teaching school as well.
So you were working at the CD store.
Yeah, you know, I was part of a co-owner with it. So co-owner I had owned this thing. And that was, yeah. So I had that little thing going. So I was still kind of doing music after, you know, I left label world. And then I started teaching some more because I taught initially when I got a. How old am I?
No, at the time. Yeah, at the time.
Oh, fuck it. I was 34.
All right. Okay.
Late bloomer, dude, late. But yeah. I knew the business as far as like, again, working in the record business and being on. When I went to school at UT, so I worked at like the entertainment committee and brought in bands. So I'm very familiar and versed with it. And I started going to shows when I was 6 years old, man, seven, eight years old. So I kind of like was always vested personally and as a hobby and whatever.
Yeah.
They told me the job and I said, hell yeah, I'm in it. My first gig was being a runner and kind of assistant for David Crosby. And that's no way to enter this business. Because man, oh man, I was like, son of a bitch. It was just funny to me kind of going there and like, well, you have to go to the store and get a certain type tooth comb. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? So there's this over time, I got used to like the weird nuances. Like, you know, I always tell the funny story about like Dave Navarro needing ginger root before they went on. So I have to run out. And this place is in the middle of nowhere. Grocery store is about 20 minutes away and traffic is probably longer. Going to get him ginger root. So the show must go on, right?
What, he puts the ginger root in tea?
He does that or he blends it or whatever they do.
Foo-foo-y shit.
So the game changer for me in this business was I had started working more with the production manager. So one day he was off or whatever, kind of take over the whole backstage area and be in charge of things like that. So, but one day the guy who was the GM of the building came through the doors in the back where all the production people were. And he's like, is anyone in Excel? I said, oh, I know Excel. He's like, you're my new assistant. So I kind of went through the doors, you know, to the administrator full timers amongst the away from the pirates.
Yeah.
And that's how my career changed, is just basically being at the right time in the right place. But I was still would do the production and stuff. So one of the times one of our production girl was not feeling very well and we had a double header. We had Duran Duran reunion. And then the next night, Motley Crue's reunion tour. So boom, boom, load in, load out, load in, load out, both with their own chefs. So that's me setting up a kitchen in the back parking lot. And that was 72 hours of, at the time, absolute hell where I'm done. I'm toasted. I'm done. I can't work with these people. To basically looking back like a week after that going, man, I fucking love that. And that's basically how I started in this business. And I just kind of worked my way up from there. And I met people on the way and got involved in other aspects of the business and just kind of worked from there. And that was, I was working for AEG Live.
How did you two meet each other?
Ship Rocks.
No. Yeah, Ship Rocks.
Yeah, in bed. Yeah. I left the 20 on the counter. No, on Ship Rocks, John and I both share kind of an obscure, like weird sense of humor about things. And we both really, yeah. So that's how we kind of met. They were handling security for Ship Rocks 1 year. I can't remember what it was. And then we did a couple other cruises with them. But we just kind of hit it off that became friends of social media. And then kind of took off from there. You know, Shine Dan would come into town and I'd go hook up with him and see them and learn more and more about what he was doing. And again, we just had this shame. We have a shared caring of people, but we also have a shared loathing of people.
Correct.
Yeah.
No, I think when I first met Justin, like obviously the humor is there, but you can also tell he's a great worker and he has that mentality that I always want to associate myself with. Is I don't like, a lot of times people be like, well, you play down to your opponent. Well, I want to win with the best team around me. And if someone's more qualified or whatever, those type of people are the ones that make me better. And someone like Justin, obviously, him and I hit it off back in 2015. And here we are today, putzing around doing our thing. So it's all good.
You think, because you guys both worked in A&R, right?
No, I came out of the government, so I never, I'm strictly all security.
Oh, okay. I ran around.
Yeah, and I kicked around. I did venue ops for a long time too. So that kind of, and I dealt with security and I dealt with, you know, fire departments and EMT and stuff like that, and had some training in EMT in my earlier days. So I was very familiar with the business as far as that. And the whole like in this moment thing came along because I'm also a photographer, so they were needing a photographer video guy and they wanted someone halfway through the tour that was more video centric. I'm more of a photo centric guy.
So wait, when you say they, we're talking about Shiprocked or?
No, in this moment.
Down? Oh, in this moment.
Yeah. And then, so basically, so when they brought in someone new, well, their security guy was leaving and they offered me the gig. You think you can do it? I'm like, yeah. So that's what got me started doing that type of aspect of things.
Cool. So Shiprocked, can I bring my Celine Dion CD collection on the boat?
I have sure, go overboard. That's fine.
I got them all. I got everything.
No, man, it's funny. That, you know what? There's probably people that listen to that stuff. Hey, man, you bring those and I'll bring my, you know, I'll bring all of my my Seals and Cross and my Cat Stevens stuff.
Fucking love Seals.
We can have a jamboree.
Did you know that England Dan was related to the Seals, dude? Dan Seals?
Did not know that.
Just found it out.
It's also funny. It's like one of those weird, obscure things, like, you know, Captain from Captain Anil, his brother was Dennis Dragon, the drummer for the Surf Punks. So go figure.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I figure these guys, like, mom would be proud, man. Be like, both my sons kicked ass in different bands.
In different, exactly. Yeah. One brought home a little bit more cheese than the other, but that's okay.
So Shiprock, so can you guys tell me a bit about it? I did look a little. So you guys, you seem to have some of the acts that keep coming back every year and then you switch up a few, obviously. So, it's a week long and it goes out of Texas.
Well, we kind of split everywhere. We're always from different places. Like the last time we sailed in 2020 was out of New Orleans. This year we're out of Galveston because the ship we were looking for was going out of Galveston. We need a larger ship, which is always good when you can grow your business. Miami, Orlando, or Cape Canaveral. We've kind of gone out of a lot of different places, but we'll change our ports again next year just to kind of mix it up because we want people to be able to fly into a place they can enjoy.
Okay, so I want to go. I want to go on it, and I see the list online. It has all the bands and stuff.
Yeah.
So the bands go on at nighttime, but what do I do all day? Like, is there gambling? Well,
So basically, let me give you a morning. Let's say it's the first morning we've already set sail. Like, you know, when you set sail, we have a sail away show. We'll pick whatever band is willing to go on there at 5. We're sailing out of port. It's kind of the biggest show of the week, quite honestly, because it's the only thing to do at that point, and it's just really the kickoff for the thing. And we'll do like a big toast or whatever. And then bands play until about midnight. Then we have a disco, and we'll show we have a movie theater. We do things. We do comedians. Gambling, obviously. There's karaoke going on. We have a place called the Atrium, which is the center of the ship, which is this very, and some of these ships, it looks like something out of Blade Runner. It's like multi-storied and they play on top of a bar, and sometimes we'll do acoustic shows. Like last time we had Joey Belladonna from Anthrax doing all of Journey, doing like acoustic Journey songs.
That's different. That's
and cool. So there's this really unique situations where these artists can do these one-offs that they've never done anywhere because it's a unique setting and unique week for them. But like your first day at ship, you wake up in the morning, you can do like I do yoga. I teach yoga in the morning at like 9 o'clock in the morning. And then
what kind of yoga? I like my yoga. Is it flow, vinyasa?
We just do a flow one because we have people all different levels. And really it's just about getting people's toxins, getting them out of there and getting them woken up. And it's not too strenuous on people. Plus you're on a ship. So you have to control you don't know which way the ship's going to go. So if you're in some more weird pose, that's a little harder, you might run into an issue. So we just kind of keep it just flexibility.
Okay.
And then really bands start around 11 a.m. We have a deck stage that we run through. Then we have interior stages. And then the theater show started in the evening, usually around 8 o'clock.
So how many bands do you have play over the week?
Well, we have about 25 bands. They play twice a week. That's what they're contracted to. Sometimes they'll do something special. We'll pay them a little extra to maybe perform something else. Or they'll just do it on their own. Like a few years ago, we had this band called Blacktop Mojo, who's coming back with us.
Yeah.
They decided they're going to grab their guitars and go down to the galley where all the people who work on the ship from, you got to look at people that are coming from the islands and Philippines or wherever that are working down there. And you have these big burly guys from Texas walk in there and start doing these country rock songs. And it's like that scene out of Titanic when he goes down and starts dancing with all the gypsies. Imagine that, but more of a metal thing going on. So it's hysterical. So it's one of those weeks where you just don't know what to expect other than what you had. You can say, hey, this is what we expect to have, but we don't know what's going to happen outside of that. And we'll do things like this year, like Frank Bello from Anthrax. He just put out a new book. So he'll do a storyteller's type of situation.
That's neat.
Yeah. So that's what's kind of the, and obviously we have beach excursions. We have a big beach party. We have a beach concert and we have games and shit and, you know,
does Danny Hill do anything other than get drunk, or does he actually do shit?
Danny's the production guy. He definitely helps along the way as far as getting some of our bands. But his big thing is the Stowaways, which is kind of this all-star cast of players that come in. And we do two nights of those, and he kind of coordinates that. And the Stowaways is kind of like his baby, so he runs with that and just handles everything from their travel to getting them on the ship and everything like that. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to shift gears. I'm going to, at the risk of maybe sounding dumb, I don't know. I see you got all this swag for your podcast and you're doing good with it. What's a token for?
So the challenge coin.
Challenge coin.
Yeah. So the challenge coin is like this thing, like if you look up the history of it, usually the military or specialized branches or organizations will have this token that it's kind of a cool bring the team together. Not everyone has this type of token, but if you do have it and you're in a bar, you pull it out, the person you know is supposed to have this doesn't have it on them, they're buying that round of drinks. And some other organizations do, it's a physical thing where it's push-ups or it's a run, or it's basically just like this cool token. You can kind of build like this cool community that's super small and just kind of give back. So when I did all the government stuff, a lot of the times specialized teams would have their specialized tokens, and so you started getting really creative with it, and you'd have to call each other out. It's something fun, something harmless.
Cool.
It's just really cool.
Okay, so I was putting together the podcast, and I was at my friend's house having dinner, and he has a daughter in fifth grade, and she was with her little girlfriends, and they collectively said, I need to ask each guest when they first felt famous. So my question to you guys would be, it doesn't have to be fame. Remember, we were talking about little kids. So it could be a moment in your careers that sets you on the right path, some event that's worth staying, something that happened to you guys.
When I was in the Secret Service doing all that stuff, there are certain events and details you're in charge of or part of, whether it's my trips to Israel, India, the Palestine, that area, Israel, that type of stuff. It's the fame. It's not like, oh, look at me, look at me. It's like, man, in my here I am, small town kid, doing what I love, traveling the world, doing security, and boom, I'm here. And sometimes in festivals or events or cruises or a client, when I walk into a room with 50, 60 people, I'm the top dog in my field. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hard work that goes into that. There's a lot of patience and get in the trenches and get dirty, get gritty with it. But I know every time I walk into a field or an office or whatever, my clients are there, I'm the expert for that day in that field. And I take great solace in that. And every time I see a promoter come up to me or give me a call, be like, hey, John, you can be out here because I need some advice or this type of stuff. For me, that's the fame I love. And it's not a, whoa, look at me. I don't care about any of that. I just take pride in the job I do. I'm always learning, always adapting. And I'm not in here to write books. I'm not in here for me. I don't.
Is that a jab?
No, I just.
I like Justin better.
No. I don't be like that. For me, I can't live my life. Because everyone's like, why don't you write a book about the Secret Service? Or what? That was never me. I'm not that person. I have a ton of stories to tell. And I don't think I can do a book like you did, Joel, because I don't know how to write like that, if that makes sense. And so I'm never doing that stuff. I'm always, my fame in my head is if I can serve someone and do a great job for me, that is what I like to do.
Did you have a lot of brothers and sisters?
I had two younger sisters.
Oh, same here. So what do you think is instilled in you that you, I mean, you're a go-getter. You definitely want to achieve and you take it seriously. What is it?
I was raised by two awesome parents. I have older cousins and uncles and aunts and grandparents that my dad's generation, they came off the boat from Italy, hardworking, never bitch, never complained.
What did mom and dad do for work?
My mom was the best stay-at-home mom. At the time, now she's a teacher. My dad was a mason in masonry and plasterer for 30 years. He got sick and had to retire early. But it was always that thing, like you're off your phone. You put all the food on your plate. You finish every bite you have on there. You do your dishes. You make your bed. I mean, still to this day, I make my bed every morning I wake up, and that includes hotels. If I shave the sink, I'm cleaning hotel sinks out from my beard hair.
I do that too, but that's like a respect thing, I think.
No, but you get it though. But there's a lot of people in our industry that don't get that. They always expect people to pick up their trash and do all this other shit for them. But I was told, hey, if you want something, you got to do 100% every time. You don't care who's watching and who's not watching. So that, yeah. I have parents that really, they gave a shit. And yeah. I hope to one day pass that along to other kids.
Oh, that's good stuff. It's always interesting to hear people's, you know, backstory, like what meant them go the way they are. What was it? I don't know if there's ever an answer either, by the way, but it is interesting to think about.
Do you have kids, Joel?
No.
I was going to say, what would your thoughts if they wanted to be in the industry? Or if you had a nephew or a kid that's younger, like your age, when you first jumped in, what would you say?
So the book was written for my nephews because I had cancer. So I was like, shit, if I die, you know, I'm just going to tell these kids that I'm like, I've just sold a lot of shit on eBay. You know, I was like, so I wrote it for them. It wasn't for the public. And then luckily the public liked it. It was not expected. But I would tell them it's a great industry to work in. And I, you know, what's been very interesting for me, I haven't toured since 2006, I think. And I said before we started, I only toured for like 4 years. So they had great impact to me because those 4 years were my very early 20s. And they defined who I have become. A is, you know, make your fucking bed or yeah. Clear up your shit. But a lot of it was, there's a guy named Rigger Dan who was a roadie for a long time who, he was a character and he would say, you know, if you don't know how to do it, fucking figure it out, man.
Or ask for help.
Be the guy to go and figure it out. That was one of the things that he would, and it is, there's a lot of this stuff. If you want to be successful, it's not the guy who is working for you. It's not his fault. It's your fucking fault. So go talk to that guy and figure it out. So it don't happen again. You know, these kind of things. And I liked it. So I would be full throttle. I would tell the kids, do it. You know, I would bring, when I worked, I would bring people backstage. They weren't girls usually. It was little kids. I'd bring little kids backstage because I just had hopes that one of those kids would see Axl Rose sing and be like, I should be a rock star.
Right.
And maybe they did. Maybe they did. You know, that, oh, I would bring a kid and one parent and let them listen to two songs and then I'd walk them back out. And that made me feel wonderful because, you know, the parents are stoked as the kid because the parents sitting there like, wow, man, I'm here with little Johnny. Yeah. I'm standing there with the band and then you walk them back. So I think it's a great industry. I'm proud of having been in it for a few minutes. So
100%. That's awesome.
What do you got, Justin?
As far as fame,
When you first feel famous, or when there was an event that made you feel like you were on the right path, or made you feel good about yourself, your career.
I think Shiprock's been very pinnacle for me as far as that's concerned. As far as like any kind of like noticeability, it's like being the camp counselor for a bunch of adults. But you know, imagine when you when you're a kid and you went to camp every year, like I can't wait to see, you know, Mr. Johnny or whoever. I kind of feel like that person. Sometimes you get noticed more and more. Now with the podcast, I'm in their, you know, homes every week,
yeah,
which is great. And I just love that community so much that I've become really good friends with people. I visit them, hang out with them. It's always good.
Yeah. Well, so you guys are killing it, man.
Yes, man. Listen, 12-year run so far, and it keeps getting better and stuff like that. So it's a lot of things coming up on the horizon for it. It's cool. That is one of the things I do. And I think it's like anyone. I think it's like any part of time you're part of a production of any sort.
Yeah.
Whether I was working for Monster Energy or whoever. And when you're done with the day, you know, like, man, we put all this work into what? And you realize you just entertain, or you're a part of the machine that entertained 40,000 people. That's fucking awesome.
I think so, too.
I think I read a really good epiphany of that when we were doing, I was within this moment, we were doing Heavy Montreal. And we were right before Manson and Slayer, which is always kind of a trip as a metalhead going, man, I can't believe we're sharing the same thing as Slayer. I'm not playing, but I'm part of this machine. Was walking Maria under the front of the stage, and people are just like the thousands upon people. And I'm thinking the whole time going, man, my parents would be fucking stoked if they could see this. Because they knew, you know, I was one of those kids. My parents were like John's. My parents were fucking the best. My dad was a Navy officer. And my mom was English. She grew up during World War II in Birmingham.
Oh, I was born in Cambridge. Kind of,
okay. All right. So, yeah. So, my mom had this Brummy kind of like thing to her. And she came from a theater family. So, always loved. My parents turned me on to music for so early. And my dad was one of those guys when I was preteen, driving me to concerts, waiting in a parking lot far away, knew when to come get me, to pick me up. So, always nurturing me this love of music. Because they both loved music. And they grew up in that era. But, so I think walking her across the stage and realizing, man, we just turned on like 70,000 Canucks here. This is fucking killer. It's cool. It's like, man, this is awesome. This is really awesome. I'm so glad to be here. Aside from that, man, you know, that's kind of when I felt like those kind of moments where this has been all incredible. But I'm like you, man, every second I do something, like sometimes I'm like anyone, I get bummed out. Like I'm not doing anything right now in the business. I kind of feel like I'm behind, you know, people are on the road. I'm not. This fucking, what am I going to do? But then I realized, wait a minute, I got a podcast with you today. And then tomorrow I'm interviewing Jason Hook. Cool. And then, you know, we got some other stuff coming up. It's just like, so I'm like, man, that's just like, if you're not, I love being always busy, man. I love.
Yeah, idle hands are the devil. I'm a firm believer.
Yeah, man. And I'm just like, I don't know, do with myself sometimes. Like, shit, do I create work for myself? I've already got enough here that I have intended to, because it's not really what I love to do.
You know, it's funny. I got this lady from Amazon. She works for Amazon calling me, and they want me to write more. They want me to write a novella. So I'm like, I don't know what a novella is. And she kind of laughed because, you know, they're hitting the people who's like doing really good on their site, making them money. It's obviously all about money. And so they're calling, and I just imagine her getting to me, and I'm like, I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about. She's like, well, you write little segments every week. Well, how many segments? And she's like, well, 10 is what we would like you to do. I'm like, that's fucking another book. I'm like, that's a lot of work, lady. And she's like, well, we think you should think about it. So I'm sitting there, even though I was like, yeah, right. I'm sitting there thinking in my head, maybe I have time to figure out something else and send it to the Amazon people. So it is good.
You should always, I mean, it's easier said than done. You actually probably write a lot more than I do. I know you do, but you always make time for something cool like that, because you never know your stories or what you have for your advice could do. That's what fun. You did for that kid bringing him backstage. Like that next chapter you write might save a roadie's life who's addicted to drugs, or it might bring in the next singer. So I think there is something to that, where obviously you put out something the people resonate with. So why not keep building upon that? Because maybe you're still building your legacy too.
I think everybody should be every day. I think everybody should write. I think you should write that book about security that you don't want to write.
No, I never. I'll have you write it.
You know, it's funny, Joel, talking about writing. So I do some writing and journalism stuff. I'm trying to working on this book about Alzheimer's for a while because my mom suffered for it. I took care of her for a few years, and I'm just trying to give a firsthand, like, I don't want a technical, I don't want a medical book. I want the dealing.
Sure.
I wanted what a caregiver is like, especially when your caregiver is you're looking over your mother.
Hard.
You know, the juxtaposition between children and adults changes. You know, now they're the child, and it's, you know, with children, being a parent, I understand. I don't understand being a parent because I don't have a child, but every day is a growth for them. Every day is something new they've gained. When dealing with Alzheimer's, you know, you think that you've improved, and they realize that the day just starts over for them. They haven't gone anywhere in their mind. Like, you know, like my mom broke a hip, and through therapy, you and I could go to therapy and go, I feel better today than I did last week. But for her, every day, the same pain is just the same pain. It's never getting better, never getting better, because all pain is just,
it's tough, man.
Relative, right? So, yeah. So I think writing's good, man. The thing I love about the fact that you write, and John has other interests outside. I love hearing about people's interests outside of this business. I love, we have friends that like ride horses and are into that stuff, or like, you know, they're painters or whatever. I just love that aspect because we all do this stuff. But I want to know what people do that kind of like supercharges them, you know, because at some point there are times when this thing just becomes a job, right? It's just for my sure. career. So I pay the bills. But what we live for is our hobbies, whether it's photography or, again, like, you know,
I wasn't writing a lot either.
A marathoner. Do what now?
I was just keeping a journal most of the time. I wasn't writing like all the time. I had written, you know, I wrote a feature film that Warner Brothers distributed. I wrote a song for Darius Rucker. So I had dabbled a little bit in some writing. And I was really friendly with Michael Grace. Michael wrote Poltergeist and Cool World and stuff. I call him, he's like a real writer. And I called him when he was the one who told me to write the book. He had been pushing me for years. And I called him and I was laughing. I'm like, you know what, dude? I'm like, it's really hard to write a shitty movie. But it's really, really, really fucking hard to write a shitty book, man. And he's like, well, yeah, that's why I don't do him. And you just realize it was like, geez, this is a lot. And then I hit him up. I'm like, yeah, like I just worked it out on the computer. It's like 500 pages. He goes, you're fucking done, brother. I'm like, I'm done. He goes, yeah, that's a lot of shit to read. So I was like, I'm done. And then it goes into the editing mode. And that was actually enjoyable because you might think you have a good command on the English language. I thought I was decent until you start editing and realize that you say the word just all the fucking time and you don't need to say just right. that often. And there's like these little things and you're learning about yourself. It was interesting to go through. You always put the comma there. That's not where the fucking comma goes, dude.
Oh, you just throw it into Grammarly and let them have a field day with it. And you go, God, I have 743 mistakes. Fuck. Well,
and it is. It's actually cool. Word tells you so much of this stuff, but then every now and then Word is incorrect. And you're like, no, that's not what I wanted. Microsoft. Get back. And then Amazon jumps on and they're like, this word is wrong. And you're like, it's fucking not wrong. Shine down is one word, you bastards. So I don't know. It was interesting. It was fun. I think in life, throw your hat and see where it lands, you know, and just keep cruising. I wouldn't have thought you would think that you'd be doing Shiprock, anything like that, you know, 30 years ago. Pretty like
no that was a that was a just a weird thing. Again, that's just another one of those things. I was like, you know, I met Alan through an old girlfriend. They went to high school together in Arkansas.
Yeah,
and we went to her house for like Thanksgiving 1 year, and he and I just started talking. And then a month later, he was like, he was at the time managing Vince Neil, and he goes, hey man, I'm doing the celebrity, like kind of the celebrity thing out of this charitable golf tournament in Malibu for Vince's daughter, Skylar, and, or in honor of her. Yeah, come out here and just come out and play. Fuck yeah, I'm coming to play. I mean, it's so funny. The first afternoon, I'm like, I don't really partake, but if Judd Nelson asked you to go smoke a joint with him in his Trailblazer, his Chevy Tahoe, you do that.
Yeah.
Just for the experiences, right? So that's how I became friends with Alan. And then he goes, hey, I'm a year later or two, he's like, hey, I think I'm gonna do this cruise thing. I said, well, count me in. He was like, well, can you come help me like a little bit? I said, yeah. And then I started getting into like bringing brands on board. So branding and PR. And then I kind of, my roles kind of switched to becoming more of a the consumer engagement and things like that, and then doing some hosting things on the ship. So it's just kind of, it morphs. You just kind of, but my favorite thing I always laugh about Shiprock is that one of the other guys, that the operations guy, Al, my favorite part of Shiprock was like a few years ago, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, long day. You're kind of toasted, but you're still wired. He's like, hey man, we got to find stanchions. We got to find all the stanchions on the ship because we have to take them back to the rental company. So stanchions? Just stanchions, you know, stanchions, right? You know, when you go to a movie marquee and you're lining up, it's like the stretched out ribbon.
Oh, all right.
Brace things. Yeah. That's hanging onto a pole. Sure. So you have to find this stuff. It's expensive shit. So just going from like the top of the ship all the way down the find like 70 stanchions. I thought it was the greatest thing ever. It was like a game of Clue.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is so fun. This is the parts that people don't see about the business. Like, oh, it must be so fun working in music. I'm going, you have no fucking idea.
Yeah, that's it. I do say it's a lot of work, and you
hell yeah, it is. It is fun. Tough. It's fun work. You know, it's like, you know, man, I'd rather be doing that than, no offense to anyone, I don't want to be sitting behind a desk like moving a pencil across a piece of paper. I have to do that anyway, but I don't.
Yeah. Don't give me shit. You know, I haven't really ever had a job where I had a clock or any kind of office or anything like that. And people, you know, so what's it like? I'm like, well, you just work all the time. Like, so what does that mean? Is that fun? And then like the benefit, oh, I'm my own boss, is what everybody tells you. But the difference, I think, is like, I don't mind working hours because I always work. It's part of my life. And that's it. You're always, always working. The difference could be you're working on shit you want to be working on.
Right.
Yeah. That's the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely worth it. It's like that grind, you know, the sleepless nights, I got a bad back because the bus was not, you know, whatever it might be. And you look back around and you're like, you can't wait to get back to it once you're done with it. Right. Like, you miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the road, you know, that was the biggest thing, especially with the whole COVID thing. You know, it's like, that's your family. When you get home, it's weird. You can't, people ask you what the fucking token's for. And you're like, well, ugh. So the tokens was like a brother in arms thing with the guys that I work with. I don't know. It's a thing we got, you know, so they don't get it. They're not your niche. They're not your world when you're at home, but then you go back on the road and then you miss home, you know, so-and-so gets married or so-and-so dies and you can't make it because you're in Romania or something. Mm-hmm. So it's tough on your psyche because you just don't ever feel like you fit. At least that was it for me. And then, you know, I left because I just wanted to try to do other things with life, but I was young enough to be able to do it. And I knew that. I knew I could jump ship and try other avenues. So the guys that are lifers, I think, are the toughest motherfuckers out there. I think they're the great guys. I love it. So I love having young people on here, but the old timers are, they're great, you know?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting with that thing, as they get older, they're starting to be phased out too. And they're the people that
they're dinosaurs.
They've done this their whole life. They can't do anything else. It's almost like everyone jokes, like, the minute Keith Richards stops doing drugs or drinking, he's going to die. Or Ozzy. Well, possibly, because these roadies can't do anything else.
I don't know how. There's a few of them. They can't retire. They don't have.
No, and I hate. I always think, like, and I know the roadies, they're always like, oh, I love being a roadie. Part of me is like, there's a better word for that. You're a technician. You're a, like, a roadies always comes off as very.
Well, it used to be like a brash term, I think.
Yes.
Because everybody thought dumb roadie.
Right. But
now, the roadies are like
the smartest men and women I've ever met. And
there's lessons that aren't necessarily learned in school.
100%. The road will chew you up and spit you out if you don't take it seriously. And I mean, that for me, that's just a great lesson. Like, there's so much day-to-day life out there where it's like, if you have a bad issue at home, whether it's you have your personal demons, mental health issues, or a sick kid at home, or a dying parent, or your best man at a wedding you can't go to because you are in Romania, whatever. Those are all stuff the people that are really good out in this industry are the ones that can micromanage all that stuff and suppress it.
It's showtime. You know, when I went to, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I went to work for the Cranberries. I was replacing a guy who had to go home because his mother was ill. And so when I went out, for whatever reason, my dad hit the skids really, really bad. And he ended up going into full intensive care. He was in ICU. Well, I couldn't tell anybody because they just replaced that guy a few weeks ago for the same thing. So then you come home and you see your pops like in the hospital bed. But the idea in your head is like, do I go back out on the road because someone needs to pay the bills for the family, or do I stay? So like one of the really bad feedbacks I got on the book was like, this selfish asshole leaves his dying dad and goes back on the road, you know, and to go party in Mexico City. But you know, it wasn't the truth. The truth was, yeah, I drank because I was down there, because what the fuck am I supposed to do about fixing back at home? And also, you're a young kid. It's rough. But who's going to pay the bills, man? You know, who's paying for a hospital bill? Dad didn't have medical care. So there's a lot that can go on in life, you know, and then you have no vent. You got no one to tell. So I ended up telling one buddy, and then we just drank a shitload, which really helped, I assure you. But
I think in situations like that, you have to, it's like anything where situations like, hey, what would my dad want me to do? He probably wants you to get your back ass back out there and work. Go do what you want to do, son. I'll be okay. I'm okay. I've lived my life. You go live yours.
That's my way. You know, every day is a great day. Go out and like do what you can, you know, call your mom an extra time because you have a 5-minute drive, and just say hi. Or
Yeah,
all these little things make a lot.
I think it's super important. I don't know if John's ever done. John, have you ever brought your mom or dad on the road just for a show? They come to a show.
They've come out to shows. It's there every time.
They see you work though backstage.
Yeah, no, they totally get it. It's really cool because the first time I'm always like, because I take my job very seriously, and so I never have a lot of guests or back there because it's like there's already so much going on, but. When they first see me out there, I guess like they really appreciate it. It's like, wow, there's so much goes back here that the general concert goer has no idea what goes on these shows. And so
it's fascinating.
You know, it is. It's everything scheduled from meet and greets to eating to working out to radio promo to all this stuff. And it's like, man, there's so much going back here. Like you have to have your head on a swivel. And no, but they appreciate that. And it's, and again, like you did with those kids and the parents, it's like you never know who's back there. If I bring out a cousin or a friend who's in town, and just to kind of see, like, hey, you really want to do this industry? Well, this is what Tuesday morning is in Wichita, Kansas.
Yeah,
have at it.
Yeah. Well, guys, it's been real fun having you on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joel. Thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.